Going to continue again from yesterday, talking about nonviolence, and particularly nonviolence. Talk about nonviolence as a form of power rather than a form of weakness, a new way of seeing. And the question will be posed, can we defend ourselves nonviolently or without the use of a military? And most of what I'm going to talk about today is taken out of a book written by Ron Sider and Dick Taylor, Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope, a book for Christian peacemakers, and I would highly recommend this book, although it is $7. Nuclear Holocaust and Christian Hope. It's a very complete book, easy to read, and has a lot of different things in it. If you also want to listen to a tape in the tape library by Ron Sider, he was here this summer and spoke, I think, on 3 or 4 different tapes directly from this book. So a lot of today's session will be repetitious from that tape if you've already listened to it. But I want to take a specific part of his book toward the end, and in order to do that, I need to spend just a minute outlining his assumptions and the dilemma he comes with at the end of the book. The starting assumption, well, toward the end of the book, by this time, Ron Sider has assumed that obedience to Christ means that Christians cannot participate in nuclear war, that it's contrary to God's will. And I think even if not all of us are at that point, maybe if we could pretend that we're at that point for the purpose of discussion, and then maybe some other time still talk about that issue of whether nuclear war is contrary to God's will. But Sider says to live in obedient faith means to no longer rely on modern war. And not only are we not to use weapons of mass destruction, but we should not even threaten to use them. Because if the act of war is against God's will, then the threat to do that and to prepare to do that is also against God's will. And Sider outlines throughout his book the immorality of all areas of war, including total nuclear war, a limited attack against cities, a limited nuclear attack against military targets, as well as simply having deterrence without using weapons. He says all of those are immoral and Christian cannot participate in that. And he uses both the pacifist tradition that he comes from and also the justifiable war criteria that we use. So that's the assumption that we're starting with. And just as a side note, he also mentions that many other Christians and non-Christians come at it from another angle, not only that nuclear war is immoral, but that it's ineffective. And they say that we should not use nuclear weapons simply because it doesn't work. Some say that deterrence has worked for some 37 years and we shouldn't give it up. But others say that it's and Dan in his book says that it's a mad race toward destruction. He has two cars kind of going off a cliff. I think Jim White mentioned that it's same as someone jumping off a tall building and at the 10th floor saying, so far, so good. But many people say that simply it's leading to mass destruction, and many are predicting the inevitable use of nuclear weapons, and that certainly would be immoral. Gene Sharp says that simply, today, military power often exists without real capacity to defend in struggle the people and society relying upon it. Often it only threatens mutual annihilation. The point that today military power often exists without real capacity to defend in struggle the people and society relying upon military power. It doesn't have that capacity anymore. In other words, that in nuclear age, there is no military defense. Some people were making those arguments as well as the other argument that it's immoral. And I think for us as Christians, it simply suffices to say that nuclear war and possession of nuclear weapons is immoral, since our main concern should be, as Christians, to follow Jesus in obedient faith rather than to simply defend the United States or any other nation. But we'll start with that assumption for today. Sider also lays out a dilemma that puts us in, and I want to talk about that. He goes on to say that it is legitimate to have some interest in an effective system of defense for our country, to protect our nation's cherished values and our liberties, against outside aggression. So Sider says that we as Christians should have some sort of concern for security, but that we should do that without affirming the need or accepting the need for weapons of mass destruction. You understand the dilemma that puts us in? That some system of defense is acceptable. We should be concerned about that. America is a good place to live, probably a better place to live than Soviet Union as far as freedoms and liberties go. It's something to protect, and we should be concerned about that, but we should do that without accepting the need for weapons of mass destruction. And so far, the only way that we've sought to defend ourselves is through a reliance on military power. And this is the dilemma that Sider talks about. It really takes the form of another what-if question. What if a large number of American Christians decided to hold this point of view? I mean, when you think about it, 250-some million Christians, or at least people claiming membership in a church, I think over half the adult population in the country attends church regularly. What would happen if this attitude were taken seriously by more than just a minority of Christians in America? What if everybody, all the Christians, renounced war and military preparations? What would that do to the defense posture of the United States? Wouldn't the Russians march in if they knew that and destroy everything that we had? That's the dilemma. That on the one hand, obedient faith calls for the renunciation of modern war. On the other hand, if a large number of people were committed to that faith and committed to that idea, that would undercut our nation's military posture and possibly open us up to a Soviet attack. Does everyone sort of understand the dilemma that he sets up for us? One option, Sider says, in the face of this dilemma, would be to downplay the Russian threat. And Tim mentioned the other night that we certainly do have an irrational attitude toward the Russians, that I would agree that to some extent they aren't as evil as we make them out to be, or that they aren't the devils we think that they are. We should not see them as the source of all evil in the world. I mean, evil comes from many sources, even perhaps our own country, and something we should face up to, that evils and injustices are committed on our part too. But I don't think that we can completely ignore the Soviet threat. The definition of threat in the dictionary is expression of an intention to inflict evil, injury, or damage on another. And by that definition, the very fact that they have their weapons pointed at us is a physical threat to us. Physically, their weapons are aimed at us to destroy us. Ideologically, Soviet communism remains a major competing philosophy. It challenges much of what we're about in democracy. Little value of freedom of thought, of assembly, of expression. Also, they've shown their willingness to use military force and subversion to achieve their ends, just as we have. And they've shown that by their military buildup and intervention in Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Afghanistan, by the presence of Soviet or Cuban troops or military advisors in Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Libya, South Yemen, and on and on. Sider says, and I think I agree with him, that if America's defense were abandoned unilaterally without anything put in its place, the United States would face the danger of a Soviet invasion. And I don't think that we can prove that. But even if we can't prove that, even if the Soviets didn't invade, if you look at a realistic analysis of history, we'll show that wars will continue on and on. Even if it's not the Soviets, it'll be somebody else, and perhaps a new Nazism or the like. So the point isn't that there isn't a threat, but the question is, the dilemma is how to respond to that threat. Normally in such cases, when our peaceful efforts have failed, we've resorted to military power to protect our independence. War has provided that means to fight off invaders, those who threaten our liberty. So given that reality now, how do Christians respond to that? What is our answer? Is there any way to incorporate biblical faith into a system of national defense? And that will be the question for today. Is there any questions so far? Okay. Sider says that an answer to this dilemma, a way out, would be found in a defense system that doesn't rely upon military weapons, yet would give us the hope of protecting our liberties and our life. If that kind of means were available, it could serve as a substitute or an alternative for military defense and war. And even to say that there is an alternative to that is kind of shocking to us, or sounds absurd, or pretty startling that that there could be an alternative, because military defense for us is such an assumption. Defense, when we think of defense, we think of military defense. Non-military defense sounds like a contradiction in terms. So I think we cling to that military defense because we don't see any alternatives. It's the only thing we know. And although it might sound absurd to talk about non-military defense, Sider's point, isn't it really the current wisdom of the day that is naive or absurd? And what I want to talk about today, or what we want to address now, is that there is another realistic, viable, practical, alternative way to defending America without military defense. There are scholars now, military experts, theologians, peace advocates, all sorts of people who believe that non-military defense is a viable option for the United States. Several European countries, including Sweden, Norway, Denmark, the Netherlands, have taken a serious interest and studied non-military defense. In fact, Sweden, in December of 1980, the Swedish government authorized its Minister of Defense to set up a special governmental body to prepare a plan for non-military defense as part of Sweden's overall defense strategy. Also, some people in our own war colleges are studying the possibility of non-military defense. A man by the name of Gene Sharp is probably the leading, the most knowledgeable person on the theory of nonviolent and non-military defense. Two of his books that I've used, Exploring Nonviolent Alternatives, and part one of his book, Politics of Nonviolent Action. This is in the bookstore, and they're both in the library. Gene Sharp. And the other book that I'm using, too, is Nonviolence, A Christian Interpretation by William Miller. I think most importantly, non-military defense has had a history. It's worked in the past, and that's something that we don't realize. So I want to spend a few minutes citing some examples. And on the handout, I think I need one of those just to point out. Are there extras or not? Okay. This is from Gene Sharp's book, Exploring Nonviolent Alternatives, and I think it's a rather old book. Let's see. 1971. He has a newer one out. I think it's part two of this book, where he has hundreds of cases of nonviolent action. So this is an incomplete list, but just an explanation. You'll see the letters L, G, and S, M behind each of those examples, and M, X. L, G would be where there's a large number of people involved. Up to, you know, thousands of people. Small would be under 50 people involved in nonviolent struggle. MX would be where primarily the struggle is nonviolent, but there also occasionally were violent measures used. Mixed, yeah. And there's also a couple that say I and D, which is individual. But 85 examples of cases of nonviolent action throughout the world. And as I said, it's an incomplete list, but I think it's interesting for us just to see that there are instances where nonviolence has been used in exploitation and economic grievances against minorities and other kinds of injustices. On the back side, the ones we're going to take a look at today, I only have time for a couple, are the four that are circled. And the first that I want to talk about is Hungary's war without weapons. I think it's a good illustration because it's relatively unknown. It took place in 1859. I think it's also important because Protestant churches played a large role in the resistance. So I want to talk a little bit about Hungary and nonviolent resistance. Hungary, at times in history, was an independent kingdom with their own parliament and their own called the Diet and its own constitution. But in the late 1700s and the early 1800s, Hungary was taken over by Austria and ruled by Austria. And they came in and disbanded the constitution and just ruled with military presence. In fact, they even ordered that in the mid-1800s, they even ordered that the German language be spoken in all the courts and all the schools above the primary level. In 1849, a Hungarian military revolt was crushed by Austrian rule, by Austrian troops, and Austria made savage reprisals against Hungary and put their country under martial law. As I said, the diet was suppressed, the constitution was repealed, and the country was divided into districts that were ruled by Austrian military officers. And since both the leaders of the Lutheran and the Reformed churches had been very supportive of the Hungarian armed revolt, many of their leaders were imprisoned, and their autonomous church organization was dissolved. So Hungary seemed militarily defeated. It didn't seem like they had a lot of hope other than to just submit to Austrian rule. But the spark of non-military revolt was lit by a man by the name of Franz Diak, who was a highly respected Hungarian lawyer, who, when the Austrian Minister of Justice tried to confer with him in 1850, he just simply refused, saying that the Hungarian constitution had to be reinstated first. And he published, he wrote a letter of refusal, and then it was published widely, and it urged his countrymen to neither recognize Austrian rule nor to seek to repel it by force. And in later statements, he continually warned against violence, but he pleaded for absolute resistance to, quote, to a foreign assembly sitting in the capital of a foreign country, the right to make laws for ourselves and for our children. The Protestant churches then spearheaded all of the resistance. When the Austrians tried to prevent church councils from meeting, they met in full force. In one instance, over 500 church leaders shouted at an Austrian official with troops stationed outside the building. He said, "We shall hold the meeting, we will not disperse." And he just continued to say that in front of troops outside the church. When Austrians demanded that a decree be read from every pulpit, every minister refused to read it. Many were arrested as a result. Police broke up church meetings, only to find that huge crowds would gather outside wherever a church leader spoke in defiance of Austrian law. To show solidarity with arrested church leaders, students dressed in black held silent demonstrations. Many were imprisoned, but those who were not imprisoned carried on with church affairs as if Austrian rule didn't even exist. When Austria tried to tighten its control, Franz Diak contended, "We can hold our own against armed force. If suffering be necessary, suffer with dignity." The Austrians ordered the diet and the local governments dissolved, but Hungarian officials refused and continued to meet until Austrian troops forced them out of their chambers at gunpoint. They held protest marches and met informally under other auspices and continued their work. Here's an interesting point, I think, that when the Austrian tax collectors came around to collect taxes from the Hungarians, they refused to pay, saying that they were illegal persons. And the police seized the tax refusers' goods, and the Austrians then tried to auction off those goods. And first of all, they discovered they had to bring in an Austrian auctioneer because they couldn't find a Hungarian one that would do it. Then they found that none of the Hungarians would bid on any of the property, so they could eventually not auction it off. Hungarians also boycotted all Austrian goods and ostracized all of the Austrian military. And almost after all of this activity, all these tactics led to London Times to editorialize, "Passive resistance can be so organized as to become more troublesome than armed rebellion." That was a statement by the London Times. But after almost 20 years of struggle, Austria found itself derided in the foreign press, threatened by war with Prussia. Hungarian nationalism and pride, meanwhile, was flourishing. And finally, in December of 1866, Austria agreed to reopen the Diet and to restore its constitution in 1867. So primarily through non-military means, Hungary resisted outside tyranny and won complete internal dependence and their constitution back and prevented the church from going under. I think examples like that one often bring up the question, well, what about, you know, a Hitler? In fact, this article that John showed me, I forget what paper it's from. Do you remember? Yeah, seems not here. Two articles. Can you try Gandhi and nonviolence to free Eastern Europe? And the second one says, no, it works only against democratic rulers. And the second one suggested that Gandhi's strategies could not work against anyone except rulers like the British. The second example I want to talk about has to do with the Nazism. The country of Norway confronted Nazism in the 1940s when the Nazis occupied Norway, and with the idea being Hitler's idea to establish a fascist corporative state in Norway. And he sent to be in charge a man named Quisling, a Norwegian fascist, as head of the state. And the constitution, of course, was abolished, and all elections were abolished, all government offices were filled, from above. The government was backed by a group called the Herd, which is a military police unit modeled somewhat after the German the military troopers, stormtroopers. Quisling's goal was to transform Norway into a fascist state, and as his first sort of target for this, he selected the country's teachers who were in charge of teaching the youth. These were his first recruits. And during late 1940 and 1941, Quisling issued some decrees, first of all, that his portrait be hung in all the schools, and that the curriculum had to be revised along fascist lines, and the teachers had to teach all of this stuff. And he wanted to start a fascist youth movement that everyone would join, and a teachers' union that was headed by the military group. The teachers simply refused. They agreed on common guidelines. Do not obey government orders that conflict with conscience. Do not teach Nazi propaganda. Do not cooperate with fascist organizations. Resistance leaders met in Oslo and issued a declaration which they distributed widely. It said that Quisling's orders went against conscience and therefore should not be obeyed. Within weeks, 12,000 of Norway's 14,000 teachers had signed the declaration and simply refused to join the new union. Massive numbers of students refused to join the fascist youth movement, and over 200,000 parents of all Norway's all over Norway's and all of 200,000 parents and all of Norway's Lutheran bishops wrote letters of protest to Quisling. And when the few fascist teachers attempted to hold class, students refused to go. And as a result, the government closed the schools in February of 1941. Teachers then responded by holding classes in their own homes. 1,300 teachers, as a result of that, were arrested and sent to Gestapo-like concentration camps in the far north of Norway, in the frigid north. The arrested teachers, though held firm, they were forced to on starvation rations and forced to do torture gymnastics in the snow, but only 32 teachers gave in. The remaining teachers, the school was reopened again, the remaining teachers refused to join the fascist union. And the Gestapo then spread a rumor that if the remaining teachers did not cooperate, then the 1,300 that were in prison would be killed. And then followed a long struggle of conscience and the teachers deciding what to do, and they decided to continue the resistance. So in response, Quisling sent the arrested teachers to another concentration camp farther north in the Arctic Circle, where they were forced to do hard labor along with other prisoners of war. And as the train load of teachers passed through the mountains, children from the schools would come to the train stations and sing national and patriotic songs to urge and encourage the teachers that were being brought up there in cattle cars.
How many was that?
1,300.
Oh, you said the rest of the teachers were from?
No, the ones who were already in prison were just moved to another concentration camp. They weren't. Only two of them, I think, died in the freezing weather. Quisling believed that these kind of harsh measures would intimidate the teachers, but they refused to back down. Their encouragement inspired the whole nation. And finally, in 1942, at the end of 1942, he released the arrested prisoners, or the teachers, and they came back to a triumphal procession. And Quisling announced an exasperation at one of the schools. You teachers have destroyed everything for me. And when that didn't work with the teachers, he went to other areas, also without success. Mostly because of non-military resistance. The Norwegians published illegal newspapers and distributed thousands of leaflets to protest the occupation. Labor unions struck and sabotaged machinery in spite of imprisonments and executions of labor leaders. Citizens wore paper clips on their lapels to announce the fact that they should keep together. They never spoke to German soldiers and never sat beside them on buses, but they treated them as if they weren't even there. There was a general sports strike throughout the entire time of the occupation, and that started as a result of German soldiers just wanting to play informal football games with Norwegian folks, and it turned into the Germans infiltrating the sports organizations and appointing themselves as head, and that led to a widespread strike and boycott of all sports activities and sports events in the country. Well, all sports activities at which Germans were present or participating were completely boycotted during the whole occupation, and there were illegal and unofficial sports events that were held and widely attended, but no official sports events throughout the years that the Germans were there. When the Nazis tried to round up Norwegian Jews, over half of them were successfully hidden and smuggled over to Sweden. The church also had a very important role in the resistance. The Norwegian Evangelical Lutheran Church, which is the state church in Norway, its pastors gave sermons and issued pastoral letters protesting the terrorism of the herd, the encroachment of democracy. And Quisling tried to recruit pastors into a new Christian unity movement, which was actually a fascist religious movement. Only 20 of Norway's 1,000 ministers joined, and these ministers were boycotted by most of their congregation. In early 1942, I think this is funny, that the government ordered that the 11 o'clock service at Norway's, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, Nidaros Cathedral, the 11 o'clock service would be given by a fascist clergyman, that the sermon would be given by a fascist. The cathedral's rector, the one who would normally lead the liturgy, announced that he would give a service at 2 o'clock, an alternative service. And only a handful of people came to the morning service, but thousands came to the afternoon service, so much that they had to close the doors, and several thousand people lined up outside in freezing below temperatures to sing, "O Mighty Fortress is Our God." Next day, the government fired that pastor, and as a response, all the bishops resigned. In the church. They resigned their posts and affirming their intention to continue pastoring their people. Then as a response, the Roman Catholic bishop issued a supporting statement, and he was summoned to Gestapo headquarters and threatened in order to withdraw his signature, and he responded, "You can take my head but not my signature." So he refused to withdraw that. In 1942, in April, 93% of Norway's Lutheran clergy followed their bishop's lead and resigned from the fascist-run state church. And Quisling tried to get around this, and he appointed himself the head of the church and all of his followers his pastors. But the parishioners boycotted all the services. No one ever came. Most of them followed their other pastors. Edvin Birgrav, Bishop of Oslo, who was head of the church, spoke so strongly against the government that they forbade him to preach at all. And they finally arrested him and put him under house arrest. And he was guarded by 12 special police that were under instructions not to permit him visitors. But the bishop's loving and forthright manner, after a while, won over his captors so that, after a while, he was visiting with resistance leaders all the time. In fact, one guard even made a police uniform to fit the bishop so he could travel in disguise to Oslo. Eventually, in 1945, his guards helped him to escape. And the bishop, concerned that the men would be shot for aiding him, tied them up with British parachute cords, so that giving the impression that he had escaped and tied them up. Quisling finally gave up his efforts in frustration to control the Norwegian church, and then Hitler finally ordered Quisling just to forget the whole thing, the fascist state. And I think it's a remarkable kind of nonviolent resistance because it was spontaneous, and there seemed to be no apparent foreknowledge of any tactics or strategies. It was relatively unplanned, and no preparation or advanced training for it. Just a few words about Denmark at the same time in the 40s. Denmark, the whole population used nonviolent means to resist Hitler's hopes to exterminate the Danish Jewish population. Denmark, unlike a lot of other European countries, didn't make a lot of anti-Jewish laws. They didn't take away their property or kick them out of the government. But in 1943, Hitler insisted that Danish Jews be shipped to concentration camps and exterminated. Some people in Denmark were tipped off a couple weeks early that extermination or that the rounding up of Jews would happen in a couple weeks. And the Danes systematically transported 7,000 of them into Sweden during those few days. As one writer noted, the saving of Danish Jews was a complete success for resistance by nonviolent means. When the Germans came to arrest the Jews, they were not met by gunfire, but by empty houses. Practically the whole Jewish population of Denmark had been warned in advance that arrests would be made. Jews left their homes, were hidden in hospitals and churches and by friends until the boats could take them across the Sound to Sweden. Estimated that 93% of Denmark's Jewish population was smuggled across. Only 400 and some fell into the hands of the Nazis. And it was interesting that most of those survived the war in the concentration camps because of constant intervention by Danish authorities and by the king. Adolf Eichmann admitted later that the action against the Jews of Denmark has been a complete failure. There's lots of other examples. I'll only talk about one more, and that's the country of El Salvador in the 1940s. And I raise this one up because El Salvador is in the news now for a violent uprising and guerrilla activity, and because what we heard last night in Nicaragua, I think Central America is known more or less for its violence. And I want to point out that El Salvador at one time overthrew a military dictator with nonviolent means. General Maximiliano Hernandez Martinez came to power in December 1933 through an army coup d'etat, which shouldn't be too surprising to us. In 1932, he put down a peasant insurrection by killing, according to some estimates, as many as 30,000 people. So it was quite a ruthless man. He then centralized all the power. He put military officers in control of the government. He abolished all labor unions. He forbade the publication of any criticism of the government. The Constitution had limited his term of office to a certain number of years, but he just changed the Constitution. 1944, there were lots of objections to his type of government, and that led to more rioting and armed revolt. Martinez squelched the revolt and executing many people and torturing others. In response, then, a group of university students came up with the idea of a general strike. They thought that Martinez could be overcome nonviolently if people could just simply stop working and bring the economy to a halt. And the students spread the idea through leaflets, through secret meetings. And during the next 2 weeks, doctors left their posts at hospitals, lawyers abandoned the courts, engineers resigned their government jobs, teachers and students left their classes, shopkeepers closed their doors, and the Salvadorian railways suspended all operations. When the police fired on a group without warning and killed a 17-year-old boy, thousands of Salvadorians poured into the streets in protest. And then there was a large funeral procession, and I think this is an interesting point. The students set up a peacekeeping force that helped to calm the public anger, and in one case they actually prevented irate citizens from lynching the army chief of staff. So they risked their lives in order to save the enemy. At first, Martinez was adamant. When a delegation of doctors presented him with a declaration calling for reforms, he just burned the document and called it a Nazi plot. Finally, though, he was faced with massive resistance and popular unrest and low morale among his soldiers and threats of resignation from his cabinet, and he finally resigned. And he was exiled in Guatemala and made this statement some months later. He said, "In the first few days of April, I defeated the revolutionaries with arms. But recently they provoked a strike. Then I no longer wanted to fight. Against whom was I going to fire? Against children? Against youths who did not completely realize what they were doing? Women also were enlisted in the movement, and in this way, I no longer had an objective at which to fire." It's also interesting that several weeks later, an oppressive dictator in Guatemala fell in the same way in response to nonviolent resistance, just a few weeks or months later. And I think El Salvador's example is an important one. Nonviolent general strikes have overthrown at least 7 dictators in Latin America throughout the 20th century. I think what's interesting, again, about these examples is that most of them have been relatively spontaneous, unplanned, and no particular training for them. Now, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, to design a non-military defense system that would protect our Constitution and our liberties and protect us and give us the security that we now seek in armaments, that has never been done before. That would involve something completely different. Would involve a whole society over a number of years preparing itself for non-military defense, or most often called civilian-based defense. But I want to look very quickly at why civilian-based defense is powerful. I mean, why in these instances has unarmed resistance been able to work or be effective against some heavily armed invaders and dictators? We assume that the side with the most arms or the most warheads is the one who will win. And I want to know, you know, why weren't those weapons able to immediately defeat the resistors? First of all, a definition of non-military defense or civilian-based defense. It's systematic, organized, active, nonviolent resistance against a power which is regarded as evil, unjust, or contrary to a particular way of life. And the purpose is to protect a nation's freedom and sovereignty and to thwart the goals of the invading enemy. And there's four or five characteristics that I want to talk about that I think make it a source of power. First is that it's active. And that's the most important thing to understand, that it's active and not passive. It's not a sit-on-your-hands approach. Gandhi said that nonviolence does not mean weak submission to the will of the evildoer, but it's putting your whole soul against the will of the tyrant. It's not weak or cowardly, but it requires physical and moral courage. And that's why we use the active term defense, because it is very active. Second characteristic is the power of mass involvement, or the power of large numbers of people being involved in the resistance. In ordinary warfare, the actual number of people fighting is not very many. The actual fighting is done by military, which is a small percentage of the population. If civilians are involved at all in the fighting, it's usually as casualties or refugees. And then when one side is defeated, the war ends and the enemy can just march in and take over a demoralized nation. In civilian-based defense, on the other hand, and this is an important difference between civilian-based defense and military defense, the enemy occupation is considered the beginning, not the end, of the battle. The distribution of enemy soldiers in the country is seen as not a defeat, but at the initial stage of a longer struggle at closer range. The whole population resists, so that invading troops meet not a beaten and a demoralized nation, but a trained and prepared population. And I have a quotation from Gene Sharp about this aspect of non-military defense. Civilian-based defense can be actively applied by men and women, old and young, city dwellers and rural people, factory workers, intellectuals and farmers, educated and uneducated, able-bodied and the physically weak. Virtually no one in the population need be excluded. This makes possible a much higher number of actual combatants than any other technique. This will not only increase the strength of the grievance group, but this large and diverse popular participation is also likely to cause especially severe problems for the opponent. There will be many more people against whom you must act. Application of his usual control measures and repression against the old, women, young, and handicapped, etc., the very groups usually excluded from active combat, is likely to provoke reactions which weaken his power and strengthen that of the nonviolent group.
So the power of mass involvement. The third one is the power of resistance and non-cooperation.
In ordinary warfare, the defeated citizen population sort of grudgingly goes along with whatever happens after the military is defeated. They go along with the new rulers. They accept and obey because of the assumption that military strength requires their obedience. In civilian-based defense, that's not true. Enemy occupation signals the start of massive resistance. The population doesn't accept the fact that guns necessarily equal power. The population doesn't give in to the fear, which is really the enemy's power, that fear that they do have the power. The consent to be ruled is largely voluntary to a large extent. And that kind of resistance can take many forms. First of all, acts of omission, simply refusing to do things like pay taxes, like the Hungarians, or Norwegian bishops resigning from the Nazi-controlled state church, or acts of commission, doing things that the enemy forbids. In various ways, they defy the enemy and dramatize their disapproval of occupation and maintain allegiance to their way of life. And even to the point of punishment, either imprisonment or torture or death, they do not do the enemy's will. And ultimately, it's very disruptive and it cuts off the power of the government. And that comes from a basic understanding about the fundamental nature of government, that all rulers, to some extent, are dependent for their power on the submission or the obedience of their subjects. In other words, government rests on a significant degree of willing cooperation by the governed. The ruler has to make a sizable number, a lot of people, cooperate in order to run the economy. The fourth is power of nonviolence. And that's refusal to use violence and the willingness of its practitioners to suffer rather to inflict suffering on someone else. In ordinary warfare, and this is one way that it's much different from military defense, in ordinary warfare, the winner is determined by the one who can cause the most injury and the most death. You know, the most effective way is seen as making the opponent suffer until he gives in or is killed. Just like two fighting children fight long enough, one finally says uncle. So it's much different from military defense in that way, but it's very similar to military defense in its expectation of suffering. And I think that's very important. Both methods require the willingness to take risks. At first looking, the refusal to use violence seems to give a huge advantage to the other side. But as we saw in some examples here, and if you see the Gandhi movie, you can see where this seeming ineffective way of dealing with your enemies can be turned into a form of power. You know, that's only a couple of examples where soldiers are thrown off guard. And it's what Gene Sharp calls a moral jujitsu, that soldiers really can be thrown off guard by nonviolent actions. In civil disobedience, their soldiers are thrown off balance because they expect violence in return, but instead they're surprised when their opponent has no weapons and gives them every sign of not hating him. The question is, what happens when a soldier is confronted by men, women, and children who are not armed, but instead just insist that he stop? Instead of running away from their fear, they stand up in violence with their own suffering, acting in a way that elevates human dignity. This throws the soldier off guard because he doesn't encounter what he expects. And pretty soon he finds it hard to justify killing or justify violence because he's not threatened or others' lives are not threatened. It doesn't seem brave anymore to kill someone who's defenseless. Might develop respect or even doubt the inhumanity of his enemy. In war, we assume that the enemy hates us and the enemy is inhumane. Pretty soon, the soldier begins to doubt that. He finds it distasteful to continue the repression. Perhaps that causes lowered morale. It also has a large impact on outside people, innocent bystanders or people from other countries or outside press. And of course, refusing to meet violence with violence does not always produce positive results. And I'm not saying that, but you know, because in many cases there have been situations where soldiers have shot unarmed people.
How would you deal with that if you're a 1944 Jew in Europe dealing with a German who, at least according to their government, was just great hatred, enough hatred to unarmed women, children?
Okay, we'll talk about that. I'm going to finish my outline, then we'll just open up for questions like that, specifics, you know, what happens. I have a quotation from a British military writer who was interrogating German generals after World War II. And, well, I'll just read it. Their evidence, the Germans' evidence, also showed the effectiveness of nonviolent resistance as practiced in Denmark, Holland, and Norway, and even to some extent in France and Belgium. Even clearer was their inability to cope with it. They were experts in violence and had been trained to deal with opponents who used that method, but other forms of resistance baffled them, and all the more in proportion as the methods were subtle and concealed. It was a relief to them when resistance became violent again. The last one I want to talk about before I open it up to discussion is that's often used is the power of goodwill. In ordinary warfare, there is contempt and hatred for the enemy. That's why we make up names for the enemy, like the Jewish vermin or the Japs or the Goops, because they're inhuman, and we need to hate them in order to kill them. The enemy is dehumanized, and any attempt to help the enemy or to do good to them is condemned as being collaborating or as treason. In civilian-based defense, the opposite is true. Resistors act on the premise that the answer to profound hatred is profound love. They condemn evil but show concern for the evildoers as persons, treating them somewhat like alcoholics. Not only do they not harm enemy soldiers, but they also surprise the enemy with acts of consideration and kindness, similar to the Salvadorian peacekeeping force that risk their own safety to protect the enemy. When attacked, resistors try to practice what Martin Luther King taught, the necessity to forgive those who inflict evil. The assumption, of course, is that non-Christians, as well as Christians, participate in civilian-based defense, but Christians would play a special role in this. Of course, Christians have a belief that any national defense that relies on nuclear weapons would be immoral, but in civilian-based defense, there would be no contradiction with the gospel. So Christians could not only participate in civilian-based defense, but they could take a leadership role to really implement the New Testament call to be peacemakers, because it's a form of defense that Christians can join with some integrity. But there might, Sider just outlines a perhaps a different style and a different motive for Christians, because whereas the goal of non-Christians might just be to preserve the United States against its enemies, or just to preserve liberty and freedom, Christians have concerns that go far beyond national security or providing defense. They belong to Christ, and the flag is not their ultimate object of allegiance. They can battle along with non-Christians to resist the enemy, but they know that the battle is not against those particular people, but really against the evil and systems of which they're a part. Christians then will have an attitude toward their opponents that will be different from non-Christians in many instances. And agape love is a crucial feature of this. Christians will see their enemies as persons whom Christ has commanded us to love, and they will demonstrate this on a massive scale that the world has never before seen. Christians will also draw on resources that perhaps will not be available to non-Christians. They will practice the most powerful force in the universe, and because of their belief that God is present in those who engage in loving resistance to aggression by act of goodwill, the power of the Spirit will be there. And just before I open it up, I want to say a few words about the cost of civil-based defense, because I don't mean want to make it sound like there would be no suffering. Invasion of our country would bring repression, torture, martyrdom, perhaps hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions might die. Invading army could try to threaten, to terrify, and coerce the population into submission. And then among some possible methods of repression are levying of fines, denying food and other supplies, spying, infiltration, enforcement of curfews, establishment of prohibited zones, censorship, imprisonment in jails and concentration camps, deportations, hostage-taking, torture, random brutality, terrorism, executions, mass reprisal, and the extermination of whole groups. This kind of suffering shouldn't be any surprise to us. And this is where civilian-based defense is very similar to military defense. Victory comes only with great sacrifice and pain and death. And just like millions died in World War II, many, many would probably die in a non-military defense system. Although non-military defense would probably cause fewer deaths than military engagements. But nevertheless, civilian-based defense also requires painful sacrifice to achieve its goals. And the suffering could be awful. I mean, children could just helplessly watch their parents go to jail, or parents would lose their sons and daughters, or fear would make us want to give up. But Ron Sider says all of this and more has happened in past wars, and the scenario of nuclear wars cannot even compare to what would go on in nonviolent defense. His question is suffering in violent warfare more attractive than suffering in nonviolent resistance? He asks the question. Gene Sharp says, it's remarkable how many people who accept as natural millions of dead and wounded in a military war find the dangers of execution and suffering in civilian defense as a decisive disadvantage. This is especially puzzling when there's evidence that casualty rates in nonviolent struggles are vastly smaller than in regular warfare. I think at this point I'm just open it up for questions and comments. I don't know if Arnie wants to ask his again, or whether we can all, and I don't know if I can answer all these, but maybe we can struggle with it together and see if we can come up with.
No, I can. That's maybe one of the major aberrations. In particular, I think the Danes were so successful in resisting. The Danish Jews got significant help from the non-Jewish population, which was really the distinction. Mm-hmm. They are not that the Danish Jews were so successful themselves, but that mm-hmm. they got mm-hmm. help from that other group.
Right.
And then they, as passive Christians themselves, wouldn't necessarily have that success without that outside intervention.
It makes you wonder what would have happened if Christian Germans would have reacted.
Yeah. Well, Italy is the classic example where the Pope and all the power of the Catholic Church in Italy didn't resist that at all.
Yeah. And there are instances, I think, in Berlin, 1943, non-Jewish wives of Jewish husbands who were taken in to concentration camps, 6,000 of them in the middle of Berlin, just stormed the gate, but protested outside the gates all day in the middle of Berlin, down the street from Gestapo headquarters, and just demanded that the Germans release their husbands. And after a whole day of doing that, they just released them. And it was something that they had not seen before, and was unparalleled in the rest of World War II. Just thousands of women standing there demanding their husbands be returned.
Steve and I talked the other day after the session. It seems as though not only the idea of nonviolence and the power of nonviolence, but certain circumstances say it will work and others say it won't work. I don't like to come to that conclusion. It sounds like it's a denial of the promise of the gospel or the mm-hmm. promise of the power of love. But for instance, in Germany, does that mean that a small group, minority group within a larger population, that for that it won't work? In other words, it might be okay if the civilian population was committed to it, but it wouldn't stop genocide if the civilian population had been convinced that this small minority is to be eliminated. Would that, are there some limitations upon it? Namibia, whereas the Germans didn't especially want to occupy Norway, they wanted Quisling to bring it into their camp, but they didn't want to live there. It seems to me the South Africans, if you just want to say how brutal could a group get, if all of the Namibians were exterminated and South Africa just moved in and took the mines, mm-hmm. I don't think they really would not mind moving in and taking that country. So you have a small country where the population is expendable according to the tigers. Then would it still work? In other words, the resistance, non-cooperation would be ended because you don't care whether they're there or not. Do you see my question?
The same kind of thing happened with the Stalin prison in the late 30s. When the population, about 20 years, when the population has such a mental set that these people are so evil they might as well be dead, which is how they felt about the Tsarist regime in Russia, then the Stalin regime is willing to put 500,000 or a million or 2 million to death.
Yeah.
there's an eradication, and at that point, maybe you get a little distinction.
Yeah, you were sensitive about this a little different, about the requirements of Christian resistance to love or agape the oppressor. Is there any examples of that in a sense of like the Germans invading another country, or something, if our country is invaded, of the oppressed actually loving the invader? I mean, not just loving the National Guard out here when you're protesting, or a policeman that's doing something, like kind of a foreigner invading, and the people like the Danes or the you're mentioning that that was one of the requirements, and yet these people, I'm sure they didn't love the Germans invading their country, love the soldiers. You said actually they ignored them totally.
Yeah, so that's why I say sometimes it becomes an important feature, other times it's not. Sometimes it's just expressing goodwill, an intention not to harm. You know, it really falls very closely to a commitment to nonviolence, to not harm that person. Czechoslovakia would be an example where military resistance would have been just futile. Czechoslovakian citizens just kind of got up and crawled up in the tanks and said, you know, start talking to these Russian people, saying, trying to explain to them, and they're not going to harm you, but what, and tried to talk them out of it. I mean, all sorts of examples like that on a smaller scale where there wasn't the intent, first of all, to hate or harm, but to simply reason and say, I'm not going to harm you, but I want you to stop.
Are there any examples, though, of a foreigner nation being another one where a Christian type of the foe, which is what you're asking us to do, were invaded?
Yes. Yeah. I'm sure that I haven't read significantly in history. I'm sure there are, especially when you go back farther, like the early church. I'm sure they're isolated examples, yeah, but I think on a mass scale, no, because no one's ever been trained to do that. We've been trained to work the other way. But incidentally, the point that Arnie and John has is what many people are saying, that nonviolent or non-military defense would not work against the Russian threat right now, because the Russians would certainly just blow the whole country up. And I don't know what you say. First of all, I don't believe that. It would be to deny any humanity that they have, and also
an economic system to throw them into too. Where it's all
no, I think that if a whole country was committed to it, then I think some of the things that you're talking about do make sense. If an entire population is committed to it, then it isn't a small. That's why it worked in Denmark and didn't work for Jews, where the total population in Germany didn't help them escape.
Yeah. No, I don't mean to say that you can get whatever you want nonviolently.
Right.
That's not true.
Yeah, I was just amazed at how many people cooperated.
Yeah.
How organized they were in a spontaneous way.
Mm-hmm.
I almost can't imagine that happening here.
I mean, but can you imagine what would happen if people were trained? And if people were prepared, I just think the creativity of this country would be incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, looking at other examples, when it happens spontaneously, what if we were prepared for something like that? In fact, I thought maybe a helpful thing would just be, could we brainstorm about, and I think it'd be an interesting thing to do, we got about 10 or 15 minutes left, but could we brainstorm about what would happen if the United States was committed to a system of non-military defense, what would we do in the case of a Russian invasion? Are there other questions first?
Well, I was just going to say, you said that Norway had formally prepared, but in one sense they had, because they had a very kind of tight community.
Mm-hmm.
The Norwegian people are, they understand their identity and they love their country, and they're very neighborly with one another. And I mean, all those things are still true about them. And during the war, they're highly educated people. They just have a very high education. They kind of have a pretty solid culture. And I think they could see, even down to the smallest kids, their history and their. In that sense, they were prepared to act as a people.
Yeah. I would have no question the United States could immediately draw on their history. And I mean, just 50 American hostages in Iran, what that did to this country, yeah, to draw together, I have no doubt that the United States could draw on that in a similar way, even though we are not homogeneous ethnically. And that would be an advantage to be a homogeneous nation.
Right? Yeah, I'd like maybe you to pursue that a little further. One of the probable disadvantages we would have in this is the really low percentage of strong Christians or religious-based people. So you'd really be dealing, for the most part in our country, with a secular population. And it's one thing for us to polarize behind 50 of our mates, mm-hmm, somewhere else, as opposed to polarizing ourselves around our children. We're willing to have our children or ourselves go off to concentration camp when we don't have that Christian base. Maybe you could.
Well, I think
in our terms of our culture is a win-lose culture.
Right.
And you've got two advantages. You've got a secularism here, and you've got a win-lose kind of thing that makes us not prepared for that. Particularly if you look through our wars, we've never fought any wars here, mm-hmm, in our country in anyone's memorable past. I mean, you basically, mm-hmm, have to fight a civil war before anyone had their barn burned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's interesting you say that, and I think it's true that it would be hard because it would be a secular effort, but I think it's interesting because the justification for blowing up the Russians would be to protect our Christianity. and the fact that we couldn't rally around Christianity to protect our nation, that Christianity couldn't be used to protect our nation.
Well, I don't necessarily mean black and white, it couldn't be used. Uh-huh. I mean, we are still basically a secular society today, mm-hmm, where we might not have been even in 1942. And many of the European countries at that time were not secular societies. Mm-hmm. There's a much stronger religious order than we probably experience in America now. Mm-hmm.
The most frustrating example in history are the Irish. And George Bernard Shaw said it best, put an Irishman on a spit and you will always find another Irishman to turn it. The Irishmen have never been able to work together for many reasons. First, you had a whole lot there who genuinely loved the British monarchy. Oscar Wilde and his mother were in a sense rebels, and at the same time they loved the monarchy. Well, I won't go into the other reasons, but they just could never work together.
One of the things that maybe we're ignoring here is just, and Ryan Sider points it out, is that, well, he said he lays out a whole scenario of how the United States might adopt non-military defense. He doesn't think it would happen next year or even in 5 years or 10 years, but maybe in 20 years. And he says what will happen is that it will take a huge national debate in Congress, and he said what will happen is people just will be convinced that nuclear war is just, I mean, by that time technology will be so horrible is that we'll have to think of other options, and that will force us to think about these alternatives. And he said that's a reason to start now thinking about that, and perhaps in years to come our nation could be committed to some sort of alternative, and we would be able to work together. Every citizen would be forced to participate in some way. I mean, there would be special obligations for some people to be in peacekeeping forces or whatnot, but every citizen would, undergo training for defense. But
building on that, would it be possible to figure out ways that we could get some legislation that peace training could become mandatory in schools?
Yeah.
We can't keep peace in the house. Are we teaching violence
on a mass scale?
Are we teaching violence? I have thought so, and I've said that from the very beginning about television. But I don't know if we are in the schools per se. I don't really see it there.
Well, upholding certain parts of our history, I think we do.
Yeah, I suppose.
One of the things the polls tell us pretty clearly is that people 25 and under have a much greater fear than the nuclear holocaust than people, mm-hmm, 35 and older, to get than that mid-range. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's a reflection of youthful naivete or experience of older people going through wars or what it is, but if there's something the country could play on, mm-hmm, in terms of that now burgeoning population that, literally in 20 years could be running the country, if somehow that feeling of the people 25 and under is not lost, to some extent it's almost going to occur by nature, because the polls show us a tremendous percentage of people in that younger category.
Mm-hmm. Ted?
I guess my experience with people 25 and under, often, well, I mean the high school people, often they just felt that the war was inevitable, and why bother trying anything? Why bother hoping for the future?
It's our obligation or our duty to think of other alternatives, especially if we don't accept the ones now. I think we need to look at it, and I was going to read a quotation, but we don't have enough time, but just simply to say the cost of peace is at least as costly as war.